This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. The Biden administration is planning to announce sanctions on Russian officials as soon as later today in a move that will target several individuals and entities, according to several people familiar with the matter. The sanctions would be part of a set of responses by the U.S. government to a cybersecurity breach, which was identified in December and that the U.S. government has said was likely orchestrated by Russia, affecting software made by SolarWinds Corporation and giving hackers access to thousands of companies and government offices that used its products. Some 30 entities are expected to face sanctions for the SolarWinds breach or interference in U.S. elections, with about 10 Russian officials being expelled. President Joe Biden says he will withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September the 11th because the country cannot justify staying there two decades after the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Biden said it's time to end the forever war. The president announcing all 2,500 U.S. troops will be out of Afghanistan by September the 11th, the 20th anniversary of the attacks that sent American forces there, 10 years after Osama bin Laden's death. President Biden said our reasons for remaining in Afghanistan become increasingly unclear, even as the terrorist threat that we went to fight evolved. The president says the U.S. must fight the battles of the next 20 years, not the last 20. As always, for more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine remained in limbo Wednesday as a U.S. health panel called for more data before deciding how and whether to resume use of the one-dose shot, putting off a vote for a week or more. The panel is reviewing six reported cases of rare brain blood clots in women who received the J&J vaccine a day after the FDA and the CDC jointly recommended pausing its use to assess the issue. One of the six women died and three remained hospitalized. But the Centers for Disease Control director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, also expressed concerns they might not even be aware of all of the occurrences. The panel could recommend limiting the use of the vaccine to specific age groups to reduce risk, and is likely to issue advice to healthcare providers on how to recognize concerning symptoms to treat those patients. Meantime, European regulators are also investigating the occurrence of rare blood clots linked to the AstraZeneca vaccine. India's coronavirus infection reached a record on Wednesday as crowds of pilgrims gathered for a religious festival, despite oxygen shortages at some hospitals and strict coronavirus curbs in the area. After reporting less than 10,000 cases per day earlier this year, India has been the world's worst hit country since April 2nd. The government blames a widespread failure to heed curbs on movement and social interaction. India on Tuesday said it will fast-track emergency approval for COVID-19 vaccines authorized by Western countries and Japan, paving the way for possible imports of Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, and Moderna shots. The move will exempt companies from carrying out local safety trials. India has the biggest global vaccine manufacturing capacity. It had exported tens of millions of doses before its own demand skyrocketed and led to a shortage in some states. Vice President Kamala Harris said on Wednesday she intends to visit Mexico and Guatemala soon as part of her plan to use diplomatic efforts to slow migration to the U.S.-Mexican border. President Biden, who has moved away from his predecessor, Donald Trump's hardline immigration approach, gave Harris the job of leading U.S. efforts with Mexico and Central America's Northern Triangle countries, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, to prevent migrants from crossing into the United States. For more news, please join us at voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 15, and here are some of the stories we are covering. COVID-19 vaccination hits a snag in South Africa.
Based on their advice, we have determined to voluntarily suspend our rollout until the causal relationship between the development of clots and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is sufficiently interrogated.
There are mixed feelings in Liberia about COVID-19 vaccination. Somalia's president signs a measure extending his mandate by 2 years. Ethiopian migrants stranded in Yemen have been repatriated. And Nigeria commemorates 7 years of Chibok girls' abduction.
What we kept telling government and the Nigerian people, that if we do nothing about Chibok girls, we're going to send a bad signal and we're going to embolden terrorists to go anywhere, to go and take away school children, as they will fully know that nothing will be done to them.
And the World Bank takes up a proposal that integrates debt, nature and climate. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Another snag in the quest to vaccinate in Africa's COVID-19 hotspot after U.S. authorities paused their use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine following reports of side effects. South Africa's health minister assures that the nation, which has invested heavily in this vaccine, will still hit its vaccination targets. Viewer's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's mass inoculation campaign was dealt the setback following word that 6 women in the United States developed a blood clotting disorder after receiving the one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine. One person died. Nearly 7 million doses have been administered in the United States. This is now the second time that South Africa has had to shift gears in its oft-delayed vaccination campaign. In February, just days after receiving its first shipment of vaccines, authorities jettisoned plans to use the AstraZeneca product amid reports that it did not protect against the variant of the coronavirus that is most prevalent in South Africa. The coronavirus causes the COVID-19 respiratory disease. And now this, said Dr. Zwelium Kize, the nation's health minister. So far, he said, more than 290,000 South African health workers have been given the vaccine, with no reported blood clots. Nevertheless, he told officials, South Africa will pause the program until everyone is sure the vaccine is safe.
Based on their advice, we have determined to voluntarily suspend our rollout until the causal relationship between the development of clots and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is sufficiently interrogated. I humbly call for calm and patience as we ensure that we continue to be properly guided by science and ensuring the safety of our people as we roll out the vaccine campaign.
Nkiza says he hopes deliberations on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine safety will last only a few days and will not lead to complete withdrawal of the product. He says the news about the vaccine is disappointing, as mortality rates from the coronavirus appear to be declining. South Africa has more than 1.5 million confirmed cases, giving it the highest burden on the continent. But he said the bigger battle, the one he hasn't been able to discuss until now, is the behind-the-scenes fight South African officials have waged with pharmaceutical giants. Both Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, he said, have asked for what he described as difficult and unreasonable guarantees from South Africa and other nations.
I can also assure you that we have not been sleeping on the job. The fact that we previously did not disclose to Parliament the blow-by-blow details of the intense negotiations was because we're prioritizing the closing of the agreements in order to secure the vaccines that we require for us to reach population immunity.
And he said South Africa will soon receive a total of 30 million doses of the two-shot Pfizer vaccine in coming weeks. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Liberia, there are mixed feelings about the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. As Rita Gilobwe reports from Monrovia, some Liberians believe the vaccine can help end the pandemic, while others say it is meant for something other than preventing COVID-19.
The vaccine was launched in Liberia on April 1 this year. For now, only residents of Montserrat County, seat of the capital city Monrovia, are benefiting from the medication. There are at least 7 immunization centers in the county. Henrik Sese, who had just received his first dose of the vaccine, says members of his family have elected not to take it. Sese says he believes in the safety of the vaccine and hopes that his decision to take it will encourage members of his household to follow suit.
I was prompted to take the vaccine because it has been tested and it's always better to prevent than to cure. So let me be the lab rat for my family. I have taken the vaccine and see the reaction it will give me. I know I'm going to be well, and that will encourage my family, my friends to take the vaccine.
On the contrary, Joseph Flomo, age 35 and a father of three, says he will not take the vaccine, neither will any member of his household. Flomo says he does not believe that coronavirus is in Liberia. He also believes in the rumor that the vaccine is meant to prevent people from having children.
The vaccine is not safe for us because some people are saying the vaccine is there to prevent people from having children. And I'm not willing to live at this age and start burning. That's my view on it. I'm not going to take that vaccine because I don't trust the source of it.
But Liberia Health Minister Dr. Wilhelmina Jala says Liberians should have faith in the vaccine. Dr. Jala says the AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine in Liberia is no different from the other vaccines being used worldwide.
Commonly in Liberia, we are using the COVID Shield, which is a brand of AstraZeneca that was produced in India. It's safe. The entire African continent is using it, and we have had no sort of adverse effects from this.
Dr. Jara says if at least 60% of the population in Liberia is not vaccinated against COVID-19, the global fight against the virus will be undermined.
We all have to put our minds together and come out to take the vaccine in order for us in Liberia as well as the rest of the world to return to some normal. No country is protected until all the countries protected.
According to the Liberia Public Health Institute latest update, there are two new confirmed cases, putting the number of active confirmed cases at 58. The country has had 2,042 confirmed cases with 85 deaths and 1,899 recoveries since the outbreak of COVID-19 in March 2020. Health protocols to curb the spread of the virus have been drastically relaxed. Rita Jirobe, VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
Somalia's President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed has signed a controversial measure extending his term in office by 2 years. Opposition lawmakers oppose the action, along with donors and the international community. The extension comes 2 months after the president's 4-year term expired, with no agreement on how to replace him, while elections set for February were delayed. Mohamed Kahia reports from Mogadishu.
Mohamed, known by his nickname Farmajo, signed the legislation late Tuesday, 1 day earlier. Parliament's lower house voted to extend his mandate, saying it had no other choice. Opposition lawmakers, including those in the upper house, have denounced the extension. Elias Ali Hassan, a member of the upper house, urged the president to avoid decisions that threaten the country's stability. He also urged Farmajo to return to the talks on establishing an electoral system.
It's unconstitutional. Both Farmajo and the House of the People mandate has expired. So the decision to extend their mandate by 2 years is null and void. And this is absolutely a threat to the stability and the unity of Somalia and the peaceful power transfer that Somalia maintained last 20 years. So we urge Farmajo to return to Afsione talks immediately in order to reach agreement based on 17 September.
The September deal established the electoral process. More recent talks to resolve the electoral impasse officially failed last week after the government placed blame on the leaders of Puntland and Jubaland. Those leaders have said they will no longer recognize Farmajo as president. Civil society groups argue that if the September 17 agreement cannot be implemented, other options could be explored. Mahat Wasuge is the executive director of Mogadishu-based group Somali Public Agenda. Wasuge is calling for election of a new caretaker government within the next 2 years.
I believe
political agreement is fundamental for a peaceful elections and Somalia's political stability. The Somali Public Agenda has recently published a proposal which comes through a political agreement which allows the parliament to stay in power for 2 more years while electing new speakers and president. This could be a solution for the current political crisis. Similar alternatives can also be explored, but the only way out is a dialogue and agreement by key political stakeholders.
Donors have voiced concern about the political crisis. Somalia relies heavily on outside help to feed its people, many of whom are internally displaced. The fight against Al-Shabaab militants have caused many to flee their homes. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken issued a statement on Tuesday saying the United States is deeply disappointed by the approval of a legislative bill. The statement threatened sanctions and visa restrictions. The European Union is also considering sanctions and warned that Somali government's actions will divide the country. Hassan Mudane lectures on African politics and government at the University of Somalia. Mudane says sanctions may be imminent.
The expected punitive measure by the international community will have a dire consequence. There will also possible actions include target sanctions such as asset freeze and travel ban. Additionally, they may impose trade sanction on Somalia, cutting foreign aid, and strengthen army embargo, which could affect the fight against Al-Shabaab.
The United Nations has also urged Somali leaders to agree to a way forward to resolve the crisis. Hamid Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 15. The International Organization for Migration says 160 Ethiopian migrants stranded in Yemen for months in dire conditions were flown home from Aden to Addis Ababa on Tuesday. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration returned the migrants home safely one day after at least 42 people died when a boat operated by smugglers capsized in the Gulf of Aden on its way to Djibouti. The boat was reportedly transporting some 60 migrants, including more than a dozen children who were escaping conflict in Yemen. The IOM says tens of thousands of impoverished migrants from countries like Somalia and Ethiopia make the perilous journey to Yemen every year in search of work in Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries. IOM spokeswoman Angela Wells says many never make it across the border and find themselves stranded in Yemen. She says more than 32,000 migrants, most from Ethiopia, are currently trapped in the country.
Many of them are in precarious situations, sleeping rough without shelter or access to any services. Others are in detention or being held by smugglers. The conditions of migrants stranded in Yemen have become so tragic that many feel they have no option but to rely on smugglers to return home.
Migrants are forced to pay smugglers large sums of money for dangerous journeys home that too often end tragically. Despite the risks, migrants desperate to return home continue to test their luck. Wells says just last month, at least 20 people drowned en route to Djibouti.
Since May 2020, over 11,000 migrants have returned to the Horn of Africa on dangerous boat journeys such as these, aided by smugglers. IOM's Voluntary Humanitarian Return Program provides a lifeline to those stranded in Yemen. We call on all governments along the route to come together and support our efforts to allow migrants safe and dignified opportunities to travel home.
Since October, the IOM has registered more than 6,000 migrants in Yemen who need help to return home. The agency says thousands of other undocumented migrants are waiting for their nationality to be verified and travel documents provided so they too can travel home one day. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Nigeria, a member of the Bring Back the Chibok Girls campaign says as long as all the girls are not rescued, every Nigerian is not free. Aisha Yusufu says given the multitude of recent abductions in Nigeria, all Nigerians are simply waiting to be kidnapped victims. Yesterday, Wednesday, was the 7th anniversary of the Chibok abduction. On April 14, 2014, Boko Haram terrorists kidnapped 276 girls from the government secondary school in Chibok, Borno State. 57 of them later escaped. 105 were freed through private and military negotiations, and 112 remain in captivity. Yusufu says she knows that President Muhammadu Buhari's administration has the power and the means to rescue the remaining girls, either through military action, negotiations, or a combination of both. She says what the government needs now is the political will to do so.
On May 29, 2015, during the first inauguration of the President Muhammadu Buhari, he said that the war against Boko Haram would not be said to have been won without the rescue of our Chibok girls. And it's really surprising how he has moved on. So somebody who used Chibok girls as a campaign slogan when he was opposition leader in 2014 and to early 2015, to now that he simply does not want to even say anything about it. One of the Chibok girls, who is now 13 years old, one of the things, questions that was asked of them, it was said, if they have the ear of the president, what would she say? And she said simply that the president should consider the Chibok girls as if they were his daughters that were taken away, and whatever he would have done for his own biological tribe, if it was amongst those being abducted, she should do it. And it's really sad that a government that promised that they were going to bring back Chibok girls, today, 7 years, are totally, totally silent. They do not even communicate with the families. And most importantly, we are asking that this General Sabo report should be made public.
Aisha, I was reading in the Nigerian papers some statistics about some of the parents of these Chibok girls, and it shocked me. It says that no fewer than 20 parents of the affected students have died as a result of trauma, while many others are now living with terminal ailments. What can you tell us about the parents of some of those students who have not been found or rescued?
They are going through so much. Today we had some of the parents, and it was really sad just watching them, how they break down. The fact is that all of them, they are living with sort of ailments in terms of high blood pressure, in terms of heart issues and all of that. So series of diseases. I think they were traumatized with what had happened.
Since 7 years ago when those Chibok girls were taken, there have been hundreds of other children abducted in Nigeria. What do you make of the trend?
Well, the trend is part of exactly what we expected and what we kept telling government and the Nigerian people, that if we do nothing about Chibok girls, we're going to send a bad signal and we're going to embolden terrorists to go into anywhere, to go and take away school children, as they will fully know that nothing will be done to them. And that's the reason why at the Bring Back Our Girls movement, we kept saying that the fight for Chibok girls is a fight for the soul of Nigeria. All of what has happened to Chibok girls comes down to bad governance and lack of security and all of that. And if we do not ensure that Chibok girls are rescued and we just look away and people just feel that it's none of their business, well, the terrorists will make it all of our business. When Chibok abduction happened, Dapchi never knew it was going to be their turn. Kankara never knew it was going to be their turn. Kagara never knew it was going to be their turn. Neither the Jengebe and the Kaduna Katinaida have been abducted. So it's really sad. And today we have a situation whereby they just go to schools and take people away. And it's quite sad where we do not place value on the life of citizens in Nigeria.
Do you still have hope that one day the remaining Chibok girls will be released?
Absolutely. I have hope. Hope endures, and that's what keeps us going. And I know the fact that the Nigerian government has what it takes to be able to bring back our Chibok girls, either through negotiation, military action, or a combination of negotiation and military action. Our government has all that it takes. What is needed now is a political will for them to do the needful and look at those children as one of their own.
Aisha, thank you so much. It's nice to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
Aisha Yusufu is a member of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign. She was speaking with us from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. This spring, the World Bank decided to take up a proposal to launch a new platform that integrates debt, nature, and climate, allowing debtors and public and private creditors to come together and find solutions to short and long-term challenges. This includes new financial instruments such as nature performance bonds, which allow countries to generate fiscal resources to address pandemic recovery challenges while also negotiating better debt terms in exchange for meeting climate and nature targets. To take a look at how that might play out in a country such as Angola, Ashley Gorst, an engagement manager with Vivid Economics, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the venture.
Angola has approached many of its creditors asking for debt relief or some easing of the debt burden that they face. Angola has really valuable biodiversity. It's actually one of the most biodiverse countries in Africa, with its river basins in particular holding really valuable forest and water resources. So there have been conversations between Angola and some of its creditors and international organizations who are actually putting forth proposals that link some of the plans that Angola had in improving its climate and nature outcomes to this. Now, these proposals are early in development, and I would say that they are really in an exploratory phase, but I think that's where we are with the conversations now. I think we're also seeing many other countries, not just in sub-Saharan Africa, but are really understanding that the nature and biodiversity that they hold is really of domestic but also international value. And
what about sustainable forestry? How would that be linked to something like debt restructuring in a place like Angola?
Sustainable forestry, first of all, means that you have to safeguard the forest that you already have. These new generation of debt instruments would incentivize, first of all, countries to protect the forest that they already had. So this could be the monitoring of existing forestry and ensuring that no informal deforestation occurs in there. And this could be backed up by monitoring, reporting and verification systems, which really ensure that these forest outcomes are being achieved. But I think the second angle on this on sustainable forestry is that there is also the opportunity for these instruments to generate additional funds that could be used to channel into the development of better markets. So there are emerging markets for carbon that will allow many of these highly forest-rich countries to benefit in terms of safeguarding and formalizing their forestry sector. And I think we're increasingly seeing moves in biodiversity markets to also safeguard forests if they're managed in a sustainable way.
The framing of these countries have these debts to other countries, one could be more imaginative and consider it the other way around, that other countries that have destroyed their natural resources are actually in debt to places that have guarded their biodiversity. So are there efforts being made to think about the idea of coming at this solution from a very market-based capitalistic structure when that kind of framework often has exacerbated environmental and climate issues?
I think there is certainly a movement towards rich countries recognizing that they have a responsibility to support climate and biodiversity abroad. I think that many rich countries are now recognizing that this is both a moral and financial responsibility, and that they cannot, on the one hand, support countries in addressing the nature and climate crisis while at the same time imposing additional debt burdens on them.
That was Ashley Gorst, an engagement manager with Vivid Economics. You are speaking with Ricky Stryak from London. And that's it for this Thursday, April 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sikus, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.